Thank you very much for having me. I'm going to give you a describe to you the emergency medicine systems within the United States. It is a brief overview. There are many aspects to our emergency medicine systems. It is, you know, for us, we use 911 as our emergency number. It is not nationwide. It is actually dependent on each community on what they choose to use. For the most part, the majority of the United States does use 911. This is our ambulatory side of our emergency department. We actually have two entrances, those for patients who can, who walk in, come, and then our ambulance bay. It comes to our main information area where nurses are there. We have within our emergency department technicians that are trained within our emergency room, and they assist us, the nurses, at triage. Within the pre-hospital, there's four levels. And we'll do a little bit of overview of each of these. The first responders, our EMTs, emergency medical technicians, the EMT intermediates, which are kind of phasing out within the United States, and then paramedics. First responders are, for the most part, usually police or firefighters. Within the United States, we have the American Heart Association, which does the training and certification for first responders. It's actually a separate class. They have 40 hours of training and then have a test and so forth, and you are certified as a first responder. Most of the things that they can do, CPR, controlling bleeding, and then either semi-automatic external defibrillators or automatic external defibrillators, again, depending on the community that they work for. The next level are our emergency medical technicians. They have, again, this is another class, and these classes are held by different groups, I guess I would say. Sometimes the private ambulance companies will have their own and so forth. They go through our community colleges. It's 120 hours of training. They have to do training within a classroom. They have to do observation time, usually on an ambulance, as well as in an emergency department. And we do have a number of EMT observers who come into the department and just kind of get a feel for the department and spend some time with a nurse and our ED technicians learning how to take histories and physical exams. They are trained for basic and a little bit more advanced first aid procedures than first responders. First responders and EMTs would do C-spining, backboard, so forth. And then you have, they splint, they'll do some splinting in the field and so forth. CPR, your semi-automatic external defibrillators, and they can also use the epinephrine pens. The EMT intermediates, again, phasing out throughout the United States. Some communities still use them. Within Boston itself, we don't have any EMT intermediates. They provide a higher level, again, from just the basic EMT. Some of them can actually intubate. They can place IVs within the field itself. They have their basic life support through the American Heart Association. And then it depends on what program they go through, how much more additional training they need to have. Paramedics are one of the, basically the highest level working in the field. We'll talk a little bit about critical care transport, which actually has nurses, some med flights, which actually have some physicians on board. But as far as ground, the paramedic would be the highest level within the field. They are certified in, by American Heart Association in advanced life support. This can include intubation, obviously CPR, needle decompression for pneumothorax. They can do cricothyrotomies, thyrotomies. They'll do external jugular lines. Very wide training for them. They have between 500 and 2,000 hours. Now, for us, we work with one of the universities. We have paramedic interns that come into our hospital. They spend time in the emergency department. They spend time in our intensive care units. They go to the operating rooms, and that's where they get most of their training on intubations. They are competent in advanced cardiac life support as well as pediatric advanced life support. They can give a number of medications. This is determined by our Department of Emergency Medicine within the Boston Public Health, and there is a very large manual on what they are allowed to give. What's really funny, as far as paramedics, we work for the Boston Red Sox. We provide medical care at Fenway Park for the baseball games. We have paramedics that work with us at the games. They are allowed to give epinephrine, Narcan, Valium. They can intubate. But believe it or not, they can't give Tylenol. They can't give Motrin. That's not within their scope of practice. And you would think they would be able to give those medicines. People can walk into a drugstore and buy them over the counter, but paramedics are not licensed to give those. All of these levels, the basic EMT, the intermediate, and the paramedic, all actually are certified. You have to have a license through the Department of Public Health. We count a lot on our EMS providers. They assist with rapid, accurate, very initial assessment. Now, it depends on the community you work with in the United States. Some smaller community hospitals, every ambulance that's going to that emergency department will call over what we call CMED, that's our radio system. Within Boston itself, because there is so much ambulance traffic, we only get what we call entry notification from those sickest patients coming to us within the field. So there's multiple times where an ambulance will show up that we were not expecting. It's just part of our routine. We know, you know, they just show up and they'll give us a short triage when they enter it. We do use the level 5 triage criteria, 1 being the most acute, with 5 being obviously the walk-in patients who can wait a while before they see a physician. So any level 1 and 2 patients, we would receive notification from the fields that they are arriving so we can prepare prior to their arrival to our ED. The information that they gather is extremely helpful to us when we do get the notifications. It goes through a dispatch center, which we call CMED. That's our system within Boston. We also have you have cell phones in the back of the ambulance, and sometimes we'll call the emergency department directly if there's an issue with some of the CMED phones. Anything that comes in through CMED is recorded. The triage nurse receives the information. Obviously, there is communication between the two to acknowledge that we have received the information. If there's any other information that we might be looking for instance, when you're talking about a motor vehicle collision, we have specific trauma criteria, which I'll talk about actually in the next couple of days with the nurses at Carigi. And it helps us to decide what level trauma they're going to be. We may ask questions as far as, was the windshield spidered? What was the steering column like? Things like that, that helps us to assess what kind of patient's arriving, and then we can prepare accordingly. Then we can also notify if it's a stroke patient. We do have a specific stroke team. So the triage nurse would notify the either our emergency medicine senior resident or our emergency medicine attending. They can call for the neurology team, and they can be in the department when the patient arrives, and then expediting the care as far as MRI or CAT scan and so forth. So any information we actually can gather through the EMS personnel can help us immensely in treating this patient as soon as they arrive to the emergency department. If they're coming in attempting to intubate, we'll call respiratory, have respiratory there with a ventilator and so forth. So it really helps to provide quicker care for the patient. An organized radio report in most of the EMS providers that we work with, in Boston itself, we have the Boston EMS, but because we have so many surrounding communities, we also have a lot of private companies. Again, depends on the community, whether it's public or whether it's private. And then payment is decided by insurance, which I don't get involved in. That's way too confusing for us. Information we're looking at is actually who's bringing the patient in. It gives us a little bit of an idea of where they're coming from. There are some places, because we are a level one certified hospital, if we hear a specific company bring us in, we typically know it's a trauma, because they have hospitals closer to them in the community, but if they're bypassing those hospitals, it means it's a trauma. So we always like to know who it is. If they're requesting to speak to for medical control, we do give medical control to some of the private companies we have contracts with. And our emergency medicine, again, either our senior resident or our attending will actually give them medical control. What that is for is they're looking to do a little bit more over their scope of practice, and they need to describe to the physician what's going on and basically getting orders over the phone. Then when they come in, they actually speak to the doctor they talk to, get the orders signed and so forth. So they can actually have that consultation directly in the field with our physicians. What the acuity level is, now they don't determine the acuity level. The triage nurse does that, but that occurs from the information that they give us. The location of the incident, whether it's a scene accident, whether they're coming from another facility, if it's a trauma transfer. The age and sex, sometimes it depends if weight is, they will estimate weight for us. A lot of times pre-hospital doesn't really look at that too much. The problem, obviously, chief complaint / injury. The mechanism of injury, if there's any loss of consciousness. And then pertinent history related to the primary and secondary survey, including any meds that patients take on their own or including medications that they gave in the field. And then their current vital signs. There are times where we may have more than one entry notification. If they have an estimated time of getting to our department of 10 minutes or more, if something changes during that time, they will actually call us and give us an update so we can be aware of any changes that's occurring in the field. No, this is, some people feel that if they've given a report from the field, why do they need to repeat it at triage? We do need that information repeated to us, especially within our department. It's very big. We have a resuscitation area. We have a more acute area, an area for those people with a lower acuity. So we make a decision at triage as to what part of the emergency department they're going to. If anything has changed, it's important to us to know that. If somebody may have developed some respiratory issues during transport, we obviously want to get them to our resuscitation area. This is our department. That's the little triage area. You can see the doors in the back are actually the ambulatory walk-in area. And then this is where the EMS personnel come to give us a quick report at triage. What our preference is that unless the patient has to go to the waiting room, triage should be a very quick, when we're talking to EMS personnel, very quick. Triage nurses, once they have deemed that the patient has to go directly into the emergency department, the triage nurse no longer needs to gather any more information. So as long as the nurse has enough information to decide what their acuity level is going to be, then they can go directly back and the primary nurse will continue gathering the rest of the information. The triage note is information that we get from the EMS personnel, verification of those things that we heard over the radio, and then we put down the time of arrival within to the emergency department, mode of transportation, what their condition is, any histories, meds, allergies, and so forth. And again, the history, meds, and allergies, if you've deemed them acute enough to go directly back, the triage nurse no longer needs to gather that information. Any pre-hospital interventions, which is extremely important, especially people, you know, thinking of chest pain, have they already gotten their three nitroglycerins? Have they already gotten their aspirin? Did they receive low pressure in the field? So that's important, so that way when the physician goes in to see the patient, you know, we can say, they've already received three nitroglycerins, you know, should we move to morphine? So that's really important for us of any interventions that they've done within the field. And then any evidence of violence experienced by the patient. Was this an assault? You know, what actually was the mechanism, if it's an injury or if it's sometimes people that come in with chest pain or shortness of breath, could have been a stressful event that occurred. Were they having an argument? Did something occur at the house? Were they, somebody threatened them? So all of that information is actually important for us in caring for these patients. If we're sending anybody to the waiting room, we need to repeat the vital signs. The EMS personnel will give us their vital signs in the field. If we've deemed them to be an acuity level that can make them go to the waiting room, we need to repeat our own vital signs to make sure that nothing has changed, they remain stable, and they're safe to go to the waiting room. Any results of the primary or secondary survey from the field, next of kin information, sometimes these patients coming alone, they may have been at school, they may have been at work. Is there somebody to notify? If you're talking about a paramedic level of care, they may have rhythm strips. They may have, when they initiate the IV, a lot of times they'll draw lab work for us, blood samples. We have to make sure we obviously label them correctly. The only thing our medical center will not accept pre-hospital is the blood bank tube. So they want to assure that there is no mistake that this we're typing crossing somebody with somebody else's tube. That is the one tube that we will not accept pre-hospital. And then the documentation that they have, they call it a trip sheet. It's actually very important that we get a copy of that trip sheet for the patient's medical record. For the most part, they will leave it before leaving. MedFlight, somebody I did not talk about, will actually fax it to us because sometimes they have to go. There's for MedFlight, which is the Boston helicopter service, out in the western state of Massachusetts, the western part of the state, there is at UMass in Worcester, they actually have Life Flight. So those are basically the two helicopter services that we see in the Boston area. And a lot of times they have to leave, they've gotten another call, so they'll actually fax us their trip sheet. But it's very important for us to always have a copy of that for the medical record. The MedFlight is staffed with, I didn't talk about this, so we'll just briefly go over it. MedFlight is actually a nurse and a paramedic. The nurse requirements to be on MedFlight is they prefer you have some emergency experience, some critical care or ICU experience. They actually prefer for you to be not only a licensed nurse, but a licensed paramedic. So those are the requirements, and then you work with a paramedic on the helicopter. The Life Flight that I talked about from UMass Worcester is actually staffed with the emergency medicine residents from that medical school. Talked a little bit about this as far as in the case of the critical patient. The biggest thing that we've seen a lot of help with is our neurological patients. Currently, there are a lot of treatments or interventions that can occur for stroke patients, but it's very time-related. A lot of times, it could be from 0 to 3 hours of onset of symptoms. It can go up to 9 hours, but that's really cutting it close. It really should be anywhere between the 3 and 6 hour mark. So the information that we get from the EMS personnel is extremely helpful to us. If it's longer than that time period, then our stroke team really can't do any interventions to help that patient at that time. Sometimes we're really cutting it close and we only maybe have another half hour to an hour to get the MRI done and to start the treatment. So it's really important that we get that information from the EMS team, so that way we can start it as quickly as possible. We can call the MRI scanner, tell them to be waiting for us, and have everything ready for when that patient enters. Sometimes in the field, they may have, if they have facial trauma, or if they have just some people's anatomy very difficult to intubate, we can be ready for that. We'll call respiratory. If for some reason we feel like we need, our emergency medicine physicians do all the intubations within the emergency department. If necessary, though, they will call anesthesia or surgery. So that's something, again, we can prepare for prior to the patient arrival. We can have our medications ready, which the RSI is rapid sequence intubation. And those meds are usually looking at etomidate, succinylcholine, vecuronium. We can have them in the room, drawn up, ready to go, waiting for when the patient arrives. And then we have some specialty rooms available for specific types of patients. So we can make sure that that room is open and ready. If there's a patient in there, we make sure we move them out, have the room cleaned and waiting for the patient when they come in. It's really important for us when EMS does come in, when they come in the room, they are considered part of our team. We, even with our trauma patients, when EMS rolls into our trauma room, everybody stops talking. We listen to the report from the EMS, so that way we can, you know, it's important to know, was this a T-bone accident? Because then you're looking for different injuries. So if you're not listening to the person in the field, you can miss a lot of valuable information. So for us, we've always made sure that even, you know, chest pain, they come in the room, the nurse is paying attention to them and what they've done for the patient in the field. We can actually get more information for them, something that maybe they forgot to say during their report. And so you have that, you establish that teamwork with them. And confusion leads to misinformation and can affect the outcome of the patient. What we're doing at Beth Israel to continue to foster teamwork with our EMS personnel, we have actually had, last year we had our first annual EMS day, which a lot of the nurses and physicians did lectures for the EMS personnel. It was open to all of them. We have continuing education programs for them. We actually have an EMS hotline. So if they have found an issue that has occurred within the department, they felt they didn't have the information they were looking for or had a difficult time speaking to somebody, or even if they felt like something went really smoothly, they can call our EMS hotline, leave a message, and we return their calls and speak to them just to, again, foster that teamwork with them. We have our EMS website. Every Monday, two of the private companies that we have contracts with do rounds of patients they've brought in with our emergency medicine staff. We have outreach to all of our companies in Boston EMS, and then troubleshooting the issues regarding our community. That's all. Thank you. Grazie.